With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Some crimes can be so terrible, they shatter our sense of safety. Not just individually, but as a community. Such a crime would happen in 1973 in the quiet seaside town of Capitola, California. Just over 6 miles from the city of Santa Cruz, and in the midst of a county that in the 70s was deemed the murder capital of the world, this crime would be a reminder that no one was safe from the violence and chaos of the outside world. Join us for this episode of California True Crime, The Murder of Ida Stein. Welcome to this episode of California True Crime. I'm Jessica, and I'll be your host for this episode. With me to discuss this awful murder, as well as the history of the area and the experience of living in what was called the murder capital of the world, is Sean and Charles. How are you guys?
I'm good.
So am I.
So we've all heard about Santa Cruz in the 1970s, especially some terrible crimes and murders that were happening at the time. We're going to talk about those in a bit, but the murder this episode is about is one I came to hear from my family. I had a family living in the area at the time, and they'll actually factor into the details of the crime a little bit. And we've wanted to cover the 70s, I think, since the beginning when you guys first got together.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Was there a reason?
I just really like the 70s.
I do too. Especially, but then when you start looking at it, you realize how many awful things. The 70s is an interesting time period about how, you know, people, a lot of people often think of like disco and the music. And then as far as true crime fans, though, if you look in California, there's a lot of terrible things going on.
Were you just calling disco terrible?
That's what I heard.
No.
Oh my gosh. This is ridiculous. Well, I mean, for me, the 70s have always been like 70s films. It looked scary, but fascinating at the same time. Just how everything was filmed in the 70s. It always scared me, but fascinated me.
Has that grindhouse, grimy feel.
Yeah, even just like the blockbusters, like right. It was just weird feeling. Watching films from the 70s is weird, but I love it.
So the main bulk of information for this murder, and of all the cases I've covered, this one you should know has the least amount of information on the crime and trial. I got that from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. I unfortunately was not able to even find a photo of the victim. I looked through all the newspapers. I Googled it. This happened obviously before the internet. I searched for family, and I'm still looking for someone who maybe has a picture of her or what she looked like. And in fact, it was hard to find information even on her, because for most of her life until she was murdered, I found out late in the researching that the newspaper called her Mrs. Harry Stein. Harry was her husband. So when looking for her name, mm-hmm. Nothing would come up until I kind of Googled him. There will be links, not a photo probably, but links of all the information for this page on CaliforniaTrueCrime.com. In February of 1973, Mrs. Ida Stein was 79 years old and living in Capitola, California. Originally from Nebraska, Stein settled here with her husband and made Capitola her home. She raised 3 sons, one of whom died in World War II, and became an integral member of Capitola's community. Her husband, Harry, had passed away in 1966, and Ida continued to live in their home at 208 Sacramento Avenue. According to the city's website, Capitola, California is actually California's oldest seaside resort town. In the 1870s, a man and his daughter with the last name, either Hine or Hin, bought the land and would set up tents on the beach for people to use and rent during the summers. Over the years, Capitola would become a place people in California would travel to in the summertime just to get away from the heat. It's still very much a seaside destination today. Capitola sits on the Monterey Bay and also inside the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's a mix of beaches and mountains with lots of trees and forests. The beach area is lined with colorful houses, restaurants, stores, and hotels, while much of the city is nestled in the mountains and on higher cliffs. According to the World Population Review, it has a population in 1970 of only about 5,000 people. So it sounds really like a small town, but it is on the bigger side compared to other towns in the area. In fact, it is one of only four cities in the county that is incorporated. Today, it has a population of a little over 10,000 people. The other three incorporated cities are Scotts Valley, which has a similar population to Capitola, and then the two much larger cities of Santa Cruz and Watsonville. Whether or not it sounds like a big town, the other factor is that Capitola is relatively small in square mileage, so it's a lot of people in a small area. Capitola is often grouped together with Soquel, a small city right next to Capitola, but farther inland. The city of Capitola is part beach, and that beach is called the Capitola Beach. If you follow the coastline to the northwest, the city moves up a large cliff, and on top of the cliff is the neighborhood where Ida Stein lived in the 70s. This neighborhood is called Capitola Bluffs. Capitola is a place I spent a lot of time as a kid. I have cousins here. We would visit almost every summer. We'd sit on the beach, walk through town. My family lived in Capitola Bluffs, just less than a block from Ida Stein, actually. And for me as a kid, this was, I don't know, in my mind, the quintessential seaside neighborhood. Places look like they belong by the seaside. They look like little cabins. A lot of it has changed now because people have updated the houses. Did you guys spend a lot of time in this area?
Yeah, actually, I spent a lot of time. My family, we would travel to spend some time up in the Santa Cruz Mountain, like above Santa Cruz and Felton area. And then we would take little day trips to like Capitola and Santa Cruz and Soquel and would like walk around and see them. And so we did a lot of that when I was a kid. And you're right. Everything, Capitola is one of those places that really looks like you imagine a seaside. It's all the houses are pressed up against either the cliff or right near the water. The little downtown area looks like you'd see in a movie.
How about you, Sean?
I spent some time there. We'd go to like the boardwalk and stuff like that. But when we'd go to Capitola, that's mm-hmm. where my uncle, technically not my uncle, he was my dad's best friend growing up and he was my sister's godfather. But he lived in Capitola. And if you're listening, you might know who he is. His name's Don Husing, and he was a newsreader, reporter, and anchor at Santa Cruz KSCO, the 1080 AM. Like, he worked there for 47 years. He read the news. He reported the 89 earthquake during everything. So he was just always around there. But he just lived in a small little apartment and collected every single Coca-Cola product in the world. So, but he was cool. And we would just go visit him here and there. But we mainly would, because we were kids, if we went to go visit him, we would go to the boardwalk.
Yeah, that's kind of the neat thing, though, too, about where Capitola is located is you do have Santa Cruz and Watsonville and Capitola, and there's a little bit difference between those and Watsonville, but like Capitola and Soquel and Santa Cruz all kind of run together. So when you're driving down between them, they're distinct individual entities unto themselves, but for like a passing tourist, it does seem that they're all one big conglomerate, I guess.
My wife is actually from Watsonville. And the weird thing is, with Watsonville being the bigger of it, mm-hmm. I'd never heard of Watsonville until I met her. Like, I knew Capitola, I knew Soquel, I knew Santa Cruz, I even knew Scotts Valley. Had no clue about Watsonville. I didn't read the side of the strawberry box or whatever, that they make. Right. But, yeah.
Watsonville's neat because I've never actually hung out in Watsonville. I had some friends that I went to college with that were from Watsonville. But my memory of it is driving through it or off to the side of it to get to like Santa Cruz and just the endless fields of like every crop you can kind of think of were down there.
And one of our listeners and one of our really good friends for a long time, Kristen, is from this area. She's very close to there. And I was in her wedding when she got married in Santa Cruz, and It's just a place, I don't know, it's kind of special to my heart, even though I'm not from there. As I said, Ida Stein lived at 208 Sacramento Avenue in the Capitola Bluffs. She's just around the corner from where we stayed. Her house is high, as I said, up on the cliff. And if you follow her street toward the water, it dead ends directly onto the edge of a cliff. If you follow the roads that go off Sacramento Avenue, you come to a street called Grand Avenue, and there are a couple places to get down to the beach. It's a beautiful walk, but a tiring one on your way back up after a big day at the beach. But this is where she lived and where she made her life. Ida was born into a big family in Nebraska. She had three sisters and four brothers. Her and her husband came to California in 1929, living in several areas around California, including Stockton and Alameda County, and then moved to Felton and then Capitola in the 1950s. Harry, her husband, was an accountant, acted as a realtor on several properties, and eventually became postmaster of the Mount Hermon Post Office. The couple were very active in the community, volunteering at polling places and local schools. They were also very involved in the Twin Lakes Baptist Church. More than just churchgoers, her husband was a deacon, and their two lives revolved around their faith. Ida Stein was a major supporter in the Gideon Bible International, and she also served at all levels, including president of the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Movement.
So the women, the Temperance Movement, if you're not familiar with it, is a movement that really in the United States got its start in the 19th century as a kind of protest against alcohol. So it started was started mainly by women, and this is where you get the Temperance Movement being closely connected with the fight for equal rights throughout the 19th century and in the 20th century. At this point, this would be considered what is called it's post-war temperance. So the temperance movement is kind of divided up into four sections. There's the founding of the temperance movement, which goes, in some cases, depending on who you read, goes all the way back to the late 1700s. There's a second wave temperance, which is around late 18, early 1900s. And then there's third wave temperance, which is between right after World War One, and that takes into modern temperance movement. And that is really after World War II. So when Ida and her husband moved to Capitola and she gets involved in this group, we're really looking at a bridge between the third wave of temperance movements and the modern temperance. And again, this is a fight. This group is connected also to the progressive movement in the United States as an answer to the ills of society. So these are the groups that they're borrowing from a lot of different pots, so to speak. So they are wrapped up in a lot of religious organizations. They're also working for women's rights and progressive social changes. But these groups look at the source of that evil as being alcohol. And by this time, these temperance movements are looking at trying to deal with alcoholism. This is still a little early for them to see it as a disease, but that look at, like in modern day, when we see alcoholism as a disease that people have, this is kind of the roots of it in certain respects.
Yeah, in the newspapers, because she would plan events, it seemed like a lot of the things, the speakers or events that she put on, were geared towards not, because I always thought this movement was just completely about alcohol being illegal, but these were geared towards educating people on the dangers of alcoholism and on the dangers of driving while drunk, that kind of thing, or the way alcoholism can affect family structures, stuff like that. A little bit different than I had previously.
Well, and that kind of temperance really is at its height in the late 1800s, early, like kind of the second wave of temperance of, like, you know, really fighting against alcohol. And that moves into the prohibition era. And that's like the height of it, that the temperance movement, for a lot of the public, says we won. We've you know, destroyed the evil of alcohol. But the problem was, as anyone who's a fan of true crime knows, the prohibition, I won't say started organized crime, but allowed organized crime to flourish. So this modern take on temperance really is looking at addressing, yeah, we have alcohol, but it can lead to bad things. We need to address those issues.
This might be not a very smart question, but did like MAD or Al-Anon come out of this movement at all, or is that something totally separate?
I think there'd be cousins. I think you see, like,
it's not directly correlated to.
I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving, when you see Yeah, I won't say, and I don't know much about the history of MAD, and I didn't necessarily research into the like modern 2020 mm-hmm. temperance, but you can see a direct correlation between those organizations. I think as time goes on past this, you know, into the 60s and 70s and on, and today, this kind of like straight edge, remember, you know, the idea of a straight edge movement and stuff, it takes away from the kind of a lot of the religious aspects of it. And I would say like groups like Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous, those kind of things, they are descendants of the temperance movement. Because again, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's, there is a religious component to that, you know, giving up to a higher power. Mm-hmm. And I think if they're not directly connected, then it's certainly like spiritual grandchildren.
The other organization she was very much a part of was the Gideon Bible International. And I didn't realize that this is an organization that raised money to buy Bibles to put them in public places like hotels. I didn't realize that's where the Bible, I thought those were there because that's just something you expect to see at a hotel or motel. Like
the hotel thing.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting it's become such ubiquitous. You go to a motel, but that's the Gideon.
You check. Go to a hotel and you open the drawer and you check. Right. If it's there or not.
I thought they were putting it there. Ida's commitment to these organizations would last the entirety of her life. In the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Reverend Roy Kraft would describe Ida Stein as, quote, very outgoing and always helping other people. She took an interest in people of all ages, helping elderly people and also teaching Bible classes for young people and sponsoring them in camp. She also spent much of her time crafting. She made beeswax candles, table centerpieces, corsages, and other trinkets used as gifts. Though most of her family had moved away by 1973, she was a mother of two living sons, five grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren, something which would keep most of us busy every day. Ida's days were spent helping the church in her community, and this is what she had planned on Monday, February 5th, 1973, when she was meant to be guiding a Bible study sometime in the afternoon at Live Oak School in Capitola. Around 1:30 p.m., the 79-year-old called her friend Grace Hacking to let her know that the study group was canceled. It was the last time anyone would hear from Ida Stein. After receiving Ida's phone call, her friend Grace tried to call Ida at 3 p.m. and received no answer. She then tried again at 4 p.m. and again received no answer. Inside, Grace began to worry, and there were many reasons to worry. Not only was her friend Eidenstein an older woman living alone, a worry anyone with elderly friends or relatives can attest to, but she was also living in the midst of one of the most dangerous and scary times in Santa Cruz history.
Yeah, the 70s in Santa Cruz were pretty crazy, and they've been dubbed, like you said, the murder capital of the world during this time. You didn't just have one serial killer in the area, but you had multiple. First, there was Ed Kemper, who most of you probably know who it is from documentaries or growing up or in the area, or they use him on Mindhunter. He was also known as the co-ed killer, and he killed 10 people. He was also caught on April 24th of 1973, so he was still large at the time of Ida Stein's death. Then you have Herbert Mullins, who killed 13 people to prevent earthquakes, which is a pretty crazy story in itself. He was caught February 13th, so only a week and a half after the murder of Ida Stein. So this was all like going on. And then you had in 1970, there was John Lindley Frazier, who killed five in their home, which he believed God told him to do it. And that's another crazy story. So you have these giant cases all in this one area. And from the Santa Cruz Sentinel in 75, Santa Cruz had the seventh highest crime rate in 71 and the 19th in 73 of the United States. So it was a scary time.
On top of which, UC Santa Cruz had just opened up in late 60s. So you have a huge influx of young people coming to the area. You have the waves of hippies kind of coming from the Bay Area and moving around there. And so you have an odd mix of people and circumstances going on.
So when I first found out about this case, it was given to me as kind of a, here's something that happened. I don't have a name or anything. So I went to look it up, just sort of the time period. And one of the first things I found was the front page of the Santa Cruz Sentinel on Tuesday, February 13th, 1973. And on this page is an article about what happens to Edelstein, which we'll talk about in a minute. But there's also, piggybacking off what you said, on the front page, there's also an article about Herbert Mullins and about those murders. On the side, there's an article about all of the co-eds going missing and that person not being caught yet. There's also an article called Four Other Rape Victims Reporting. And that article goes into, I guess at the time, there were also a lot of unsolved rapes that aren't connected to these other crimes. So this was just, it's just a front page of death and murder. And I couldn't imagine waking up to that in the 70s, living in the area. You must have been terrified.
Right. Well, and from Grace's perspective, I know my friend, an elderly woman down the street, living by herself, and then to have that in the newspaper every day, I can see why people would really continually live on edge.
This one piece of article totally shows that it did happen back then. Like,
right.
I mean, this one is like, here is proof that things were the same back then, you know, with how supposedly things have changed so much.
One thing we've talked about a lot too is that idea of something we often hear is things back in the day. Oh, it was better, you know?
Right.
It wasn't so scary. You could leave your doors unlocked. I don't think anybody was leaving their doors unlocked in Santa Cruz at this time. And I think it's just, we take it for granted. You know, we look at the past in kind of those rosy glasses of, oh, it's nostalgic. And
yeah.
No, it's just as dangerous as just as...
The day after to go get this paper off your front step, you probably unlocked your door, ran to get your paper, and ran back in and locked your door.
To lock it up, yeah.
I will definitely post a picture of this on our social media as well as on our website. The next day, Tuesday, February 6th, 1973, Grace got in touch with other friends of Edelstein to see if anyone had heard or seen her. None of them had. The calls continued. The phone continued to ring, and Ida did not pick up, further distressing her friends. At some point in the evening, the friends called a neighbor of Ida Stein's named Rose Crockett. They let her know that they'd been unable to get in touch with Ida and asked if she might walk over to the house and knock on the door. Like her friends, Rose hadn't seen or heard from Stein and had agreed to go over and see if everything was okay. Rose walked over to Ida Stein's house in the dark sometime after 8 p.m. When she first arrived at the home, one of the first things she saw outside bothered her. In the driveway of the home was Ida Stein's car. This was very unusual. Ida Stein always parked her car inside the garage when she was home, so seeing it outside was already a sign that something might be wrong. When Rose reached the front door, it was shut but unlocked, another sign that something was amiss. Rose knocked at the door, but the house sat quietly in the dark, and no one came to answer. Rose opened the door and went inside the house. At first glance, she didn't see anything that looked out of order or gave any clues to the whereabouts of her neighbor. Ida Stein's bedroom was on the second floor of the home, and Rose proceeded up the stairs. When she reached the door to the room, she could immediately see what looked like signs of a struggle. Looking around the room for her friend, she realized she could hear water running in the attached bathroom. This sound, coupled with the state of the room, caused her to back out of the house and call police. At 9 p.m. on February 6, 1973, police were at the Sacramento Avenue home, and once inside, they found Ida Stein, fully clothed, face down in her bathtub with hot water tap running, and deceased. The scene itself indicated a brutal and violent attack had happened. Not only were there signs of a struggle in her bedroom, but the body had bruises, as if it had been beaten. She also had burn marks on various parts of her body, something that indicated she had been tortured. Although it wasn't immediately clear what her cause of death was, police thought the scene looked as if someone had hurt her in a blind rage. Once they make an arrest, they use the term, quote, red haze of emotion to describe how the scene looks. And there are a lot of terms like this used without really describing the scene. They're kind of just described as it looked like someone was angry or there was a red haze of emotion. What does that evoke to you guys when you think of crime scenes?
Like it's a frenzy, like somebody going berserk or not thinking or.
To me, I feel like it might be insinuating a close relative or something like that with using the term emotion, like mm-hmm. that it might've been someone she knew. I mean, if I was reading that, that might pop into my head.
And this dad will just kind of come back when there's a trial and we're discussing what happened. On top of the brutal scene, police very quickly ruled out a more common motive, such as robbery. They checked the house and found nothing had been stolen. What they did think was that someone, probably someone Stein didn't know, came in through her unlocked front door and hurt her. In the Santa Cruz Sentinel on February 7, 1973, Police Chief Martin Berchtold said of the victim and the crime, "It, quote, is a vicious thing. I just can't see anybody doing this to her. I've known her and her family for years, and she was an exceptionally fine woman." And this is a concept I think several of our episodes this season will talk about. It's the idea of a pure victim, somebody who police or even the media or us listening to true crime might differentiate because they might have done something we think caused the crime to happen versus someone like this who it seems like, who would hurt this person? Why would they do it? It doesn't make any sense to anybody. When the truth is, both those things shouldn't make any sense to anybody because no one should be hurting you.
No, a victim is a victim. It doesn't matter who the person is or what walk of life. I wonder too if this being the Santa Cruz area, Capitola, one I can see in a place like Capitola with such a small population, even at this time, you're going to probably know the victim. And in this case, this person who's a pillar of the community, who has ties, that's got to be a hard thing to deal with. But then when, as you were talking about the newspaper article and what we've seen with all of these other crimes, you know, and like the co-ed killer and a lot of these hitchhikers and stuff like that, has an effect on how these people are perceiving these different victims in all of these different crimes, not just the murders, but also the rape victims as well.
I think it does, because in the same front page that we talked about earlier from February 13th, 1973, there's an article called "Women Hitchhikers, Why Do They Do It?" And in that article, the police are trying to explain the dangers of hitchhiking. And I mean, there's obviously a lot happening and women are being murdered and they tend to be hitchhikers. So they're worried about people stopping doing that. But in that article, one of the police makes a reference that women who hitchhike are asking for a lot more than they are asking for when they get picked up, for a lot more than just a ride, which indicates to me they kind of expect that they might get hurt and there's, as I said, a lot of rapes happening to these women as well.
Like, you're asking for it. If you're gonna hitchhike, you're asking for it.
And that's on the same page as this.
Which is, and that's an interesting thing, because at this time period, hitchhiking is like a completely ubiquitous way of traveling. Like, I mean, it seems like in everything we've read, and I wasn't hitchhiking in the 70s, but having friends and family and stuff, everybody did it. You know, it was constant. Which, granted, that is at this time period, from what we've seen of these murderers and these people that are doing these vicious things in California, a lot of them did murder hitchhikers. But that's not saying that those people were asking for it or deserved it in any way because of their choices.
Right. So it's just an interesting dynamic between these two crimes, one in which, you know, they're saying they can't believe someone would do this. And there's obviously the component of someone coming into your house and all of that, but then them kind of blaming the women who are experiencing violence just because they're hitchhiking.
And Ida being a completely different type of victim too than maybe some of the other ones that are profiled in the newspapers. I mean, she is somebody's grandmother. You know, it has that grandmotherly feel that people instantly can associate with.
Her murder is also not as explicitly described in the paper as the other murders that we now know were serial killers at the time. Those were of the co-eds, or I even hate saying that word, but of the young women who were being murdered. They're a little more descriptive about what happened to them, which is just also an interesting dynamic and something we'll see, I think, so far in a couple of our episodes already, but in several that are coming up.
Do you think that is the newspaper's way of, I want to say entertainment's a terrible term for this, but using the lurid details to sell more newspapers? Or is it?
I think if you're talking about the Ida Stein case, I think this one would have made the paper. How things are, it's an older woman getting murdered in her home. When I was doing research on other cases, trying to find certain murders, no one wrote about it at all. Because it was in a different demographic. It was, right. But are you saying that?
No, I'm saying like for instance, if you look at those women that were going missing or some of the other murders, some of the details in them are pretty graphic for a newspaper, or what I would consider graphic for what a newspaper would cover. But then, as you were just saying, Jessica, the Ida Stein murder, there aren't as many lurid details about how she was found or what was done to her. And I was wondering if that has to do more with the victim and the demographic of the victim, or if that's a choice on the newspaper because it's not as a sensational story.
I know you're asking, Jessica, but I'm asking
both of you.
I'm thinking you have the hitchhikers, maybe to them at the time in the paper, is a different social class. And you have Ida, who, you know, is part of the Baptist church. She does these things to help the community. I'm not saying I don't care, but these people writing the articles might not think as much of the hitchhikers because they're supposedly asking for it, how they're writing about it, and they're leaving out details because she's a community pillar.
It's easier to discount victims when they can be seen as strangers and not as a part of them, not as part of a fabric of a community. And like you said, Ida is a integral member of that community, and a pillar, somebody who's constantly helping, who's constantly doing things for others. And yeah, maybe these other hitchhikers or these other victims they're seen through a distant lens.
They're obviously not under the classification of pure victims, how they're writing about them.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't know for sure if it's the newspaper holding back information or if it would be the police in this case, not giving as much information in this case as in the others.
Right. I didn't mean to insinuate that it was the paper or the police.
Oh, no, I just don't know for sure. But it's definitely, to me, I don't think it's on purpose or meant to be more lurid in one case or the other. I think it's an example of something they're writing about it and not realizing maybe that you're holding back things for one and not the other, using your own biases or the police not giving out information, and maybe there's good reason. This is not a case that's written about as widely as the others for obvious reasons. They're much bigger and involve more people, but it was just an interesting dynamic to see those two things.
Well, I think that's all something we too have to constantly remind ourselves of is while we're reading about these cases and doing this research, we're funneling it through the lens of second party information, you know, unless on the rare occasions we can actually get a police file. A lot of this is through the newspaper, which has a specific focus in order to inform and I don't want to say entertain, but you know, sell newspapers. And so they are operating on whatever information that they themselves get or given to them even by another party. And like you said, the police are holding some of that back for investigation purposes or prosecution purposes.
Or it could be the paper holding it back that it might not be accurate information, and they don't want to put, because while we do research, we found there was that one case that we were researching where I thought we were in an alternate universe because there was the same thing happening with a different name. And then as we went on, it was in hindsight because they were getting the information as it comes and it was wrong.
Yeah, that was actually one of my our first cases of our trip to the library.
Right.
If you're interested in what that case is, you could join our discussion group, in which we'll give you a little preview of a future case we're covering in that respect. But that was an interesting one because day by day the story is changing. That's interesting.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Maddie.
Do you like horror movies?
I sure do.
Well, did you know that most horror movies are inspired by real-life horror?
Really? Like what?
Well, take The Shining, for instance. That's based on Stephen King's real-life addictions, or The Purge, which could be our country any minute now.
Oh, and The Strangers, which is based on a real-life murder. People should be talking about these things.
Hey, guys.
Oh, hey, Producer Michael.
Producer Michael, hi.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but somebody already is. It's you.
That's right. We are Frygay the 13th, the podcast where we talk about horror in real life and horror in media, all from an LGBTQ perspective.
Because we gay, y'all.
We are proud members of the Legion Podcast Network, and we can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever your favorite podcasts are found.
And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Come along with us on this crazy journey, and as always,
get slayed.
The police have a very violent crime scene, and they believe, based on friends they've already talked with, that Ida Stang was murdered sometime in the afternoon of February 5th. However, narrowing down just what happened to her and the exact time is initially their top priority. Her body is taken for an autopsy. They ask the public for any information they have about her whereabouts during the days before the murder. They also talk with everyone who knew her, her friends, family, neighbors, and she does have a pretty big family, but the majority of them live outside Capitola. And it's hard to say, but nothing in the newspaper points to any belief on behalf of police that someone she knew would be involved in any way, and they seem to believe that basically right away. The police also asked for information from the public regarding any unknown people or vehicles in the area in the last few days. Capitola is a small community, and the police are hoping someone saw something. I don't know how often this pans out, but I do think people in neighborhoods kind of have an idea of who should be there and who shouldn't, and they tend to notice things. This method pays off for police. They're quickly told by neighbors and people who live in the area that on Monday the 6th, there were three men, not known by neighbors, walking door to door selling soap. One of these stories is from my family, who live just around the corner from Ida Stein. In 1973, my great-aunt and great-uncle lived just a block away from Sacramento Street. On February 5th, 1973, my great-aunt ventured outside to clean up the yard after a weekend of very heavy rain, and they were expecting even more rain to come. In fact, the newspaper, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, used the term, quote, "rain cats and dogs," to describe the weather. There was significant flooding, and the electricity went out in several areas, so there were mudslides, things like that, so she's kind of cleaning up the area. While outside in the yard, she was approached by a man who said he was selling soap door-to-door to raise funds for a place called the Drug Abuse Prevention Center in Santa Cruz, California. The man indicated he was a resident of this facility. While standing outside her house, the man also began to ask some uncomfortable questions. He inquired as to whether she lived alone and was alone at the house now, questions that made her feel ill at ease. And I think she was comfortable because those are uncomfortable questions to be asked, but also because all the things that you talked about earlier, Sean, with the murders. Also, there's the layout of Capitola. In this area, there are houses, but there are a lot of trees and brush. They're on a mountain, so there's areas where there's a house, but then there's kind of dead space, wooded space.
You're like secluded away from everything.
Yeah, you're next to someone, but you also feel secluded. While speaking with the man selling soap, my great uncle came out of the house, and as soon as he did, the man ended the conversation and stepped away from the front yard. He continued down the street towards Sacramento Avenue. When police talked with other people in the area, they continued to hear a similar story of a man or men in the area selling soap. Realizing this man could be anything from a suspect to a witness, they contacted the Drug Abuse Prevention Center, and they learned that the center had dropped off three men in the Capitola Bluffs area on Monday, February 5th, to sell soap as a fundraiser. I tried to find and narrow down exactly where this facility was that they were from, and there were actually a couple of new facilities, it kind of sounded like, in the area that dealt with drug issues in particular. But one of the only facilities that was on Emmeline Street in Santa Cruz had patient facilities where people stayed and lived there, which is what it sounded like these three young men did. That facility had been open much longer, since the 1800s. They dealt with all sorts of issues, including alcohol abuse. But in the 1970s, it also had youth live in the facility for just a couple of years' time. It was also a big facility. I believe Herbert Mullins was there for a bit. So it was a rather large facility, and I think this is the facility they were from. The police bring the three men in to be interviewed. All this is happening very quickly, but the police don't actually keep the public up to date, which turns out to backfire them on a bit. So they don't let the public know they have people coming in. And the public, quite rightly, is really on edge about the murder. They don't know if they need to be worried, if this is another person, like the other two people who've been killing multiple people. The police, on the other hand, are concerned with putting together a case. But this is just sort of a reminder that these crimes don't just affect the people they happen to. They also affect the people living in the area as well. Around the same time that the police are bringing in the men who were selling soap to be interviewed, the autopsy is also performed and gives them more information. The autopsy shows that Ida Stang was murdered by suffocation, and that prior to being murdered, among all the other injuries she suffered, like the bruises from being beat or the burns, she was also raped. This gives the police information they can use when looking at possible suspects. The police bring the three men in for questioning, and very quickly, they eliminate one of the men as a possible suspect. It then takes them just a little longer to eliminate the other. And once that's done, their entire attention is on the only other man they couldn't eliminate, and who, once they know more about him, fits the description of someone who might commit this sort of crime to a T. But it turns out this man isn't really a man at all, at least not where age is concerned. He is a 16-year-old named Wilford Willie Brown. In 1973, the police learned that Wilford Willie Brown has been staying at the Drug Abuse Prevention Center for the past 6 months. But it turns out Brown isn't suffering from the illness of addiction to drugs or alcohol. Instead, he was placed at this facility in a manner that will probably confuse a lot of people. He was placed here because he's an underage sex offender. Only 6 months prior to being placed at the Drug Abuse Prevention Center, Wilford Willie Brown was in the California Youth Authority because he committed the crime of raping his stepmother. While Brown was being held at a California Youth Authority facility, he was evaluated by three psychiatrists. The goal of doing this, and this is really not a very different process than what would happen now with an underage sex offender, would be to determine whether or not an offender can be rehabilitated outside of a jail setting, and also what that treatment will entail. The goal is that we find the best environment for children while they receive that treatment. We've talked a lot about adult offenders, but if you remember, about 25% of all sexual crimes are committed by children under the age of 18. And probably the most common offender you have in your mind right now is a teenager, but there are a significant amount of sex crimes committed by much younger children as well. Also, like adult offenders, there are a lot of myths about younger offenders. We're not going to really talk about those during this podcast because it doesn't apply, but it's just something to keep in mind. One of the commonalities and reasons psychiatrists and judges evaluate child offenders is that only about 2-3% of child sex offenders commit the crime more than once. So court is looking for a way to separate children likely to reoffend from the vast majority who won't.
Is it always three psychiatrists, or does that depend on?
It will differ. It'll differ by state as well as by county. So in this case, it was three psychiatrists, and they don't decide. They give their best belief to what should happen to a judge, and then a judge decides, which is what happens here.
And ideally, these psychiatrists are experts in that field, in like dealing with child offenders, or are they just three psychiatrists that you can grab?
Ideally, they would be people that's sort of what they do. And in this case, the three psychiatrists evaluate Brown and determine he can be rehabilitated. A judge agrees, and in 1972, he's placed with the Drug Prevention Center in Santa Cruz. And this wouldn't be unusual for the time. It sounds like something that should be unusual because that facility isn't made for that necessarily. But these kinds of sex offenses, which we're still learning a lot about, were treated often in the same way you would treat drug addiction. A lot of group therapy, teaching people new habits, things like that. So they would be participating in that within the center.
So in this drug addiction center, would he be going through these group therapies and these talk therapy with other sex offenders, or is he in a group with drug addicts and
Yeah, so there's not a lot of information at the time as to specifically what would happen at these facilities like this. And I don't have an insight to his particular treatment plan. So he may have, I saw that did happen in lots of facilities. Also, they might have had, this is a pretty big facility, so it's possible there was a separate group. Now, in 2020 here in California, you would be sort of evaluated the same way. You wouldn't be put into a facility like this necessarily. You'd probably be put into a group home, and hopefully that group home would kind of specialize in sex offenses, but it's not always the case, and there's not always the money for that. So, you know, you might end up at a place that's more religious, which some group homes are. There's a whole lot of variance to this, and that's in California. There's even larger variance to this in other states, which do a lot of other kinds of things we can talk about another time because it doesn't really apply here. But
yeah, when thinking about this, this could be like, you know how like the whole Scared Straight program, you put them in with adults who have drug addicts, they might learn something from their stories or something like that. That could have been something that they thought about.
The idea really is that this is something you can change. You know, it's perhaps something you've picked up socially, or it's a habit, which sounds really odd, but, you know, something you can kind of be learned out of you, I guess, is the best way of putting it. But not all of that works for everybody.
Right.
And there's still, at this time, not a lot of information for adults, sex offenders. So there's even less for kids. And I'd say that probably less to now. A lot of people don't know too much about this.
Yeah, we are talking about the 1970s when, I mean, if we've talked about this before, but this is really in the infancy of talking about any of these problems as actual, well, not solvable problems, but like really looking at it and putting the resources in there to try to fix these things.
And it's early 70s.
Yeah.
So you got to think right before this, the 60s, where, you know.
And when I looked up, because I found it odd that they were selling soap door to door. When I looked up just these facilities, there seemed like there were suddenly several of them popping up in this area, which would kind of make sense with the time period. And we haven't hit the 80s yet where we're tough on drugs and all that stuff yet. But
you have had an influx of people moving into the area, you know, and post 1960s hippie waves and a lot of drugs, like alcohol.
One of the things that wouldn't happen in California now is letting someone who's undergoing this treatment outside of jail to be out without an adult present, which is just, that kind of blew my mind. The police learned about Brown's background and questioned him regarding the murder of Ida Stein. It takes very little time before Brown confesses to the police that he murdered Ida Stein. And in a conversation with the district attorney, he lays out exactly what happened. This is information that appears in the newspaper and is based on the district attorney testifying during a grand jury to what Brown told him. According to this conversation, the Drug Prevention Recovery Center dropped him and two other men off in Capitola Bluffs to sell soap door to door. The three split up to cover as much ground as possible. During the afternoon, Brown knocked on Ida Stein's door. The two would speak, and at some point Ida Stein, a woman known for helping people of all ages, would ask if Wilfred Willie Brown would like to come inside her house for coffee and cookies. He agreed and entered the home. Ida Stein laid out coffee and cookies, and the two of them discussed religion. It seems that Brown may have told her about some of the trouble he'd been in, and she'd asked him if he'd like to pray with her. Brown replied that he would, and the two clasped hands and began to pray. This is when Brown's demeanor and actions would change. During the prayer, as Ida began to ask, quote, God to help this poor boy, Brown quickly grabbed a hold of the back of her head. He then pulled her to her feet as he guided her forcefully up the stairs of her two-story house. He forced her into her bedroom. Once there, he threw her on the bed, muffled her with a pillow, and raped her. When the brutal assault was over, Brown smothered Ida Stein with a pillow. Concerned that Stein might not be deceased, he devised a way to be sure. He took her from the bed and into the attached bathroom. He laid her face down in the bathtub and turned on the hot water. After some time, he was convinced she was no longer living. He left the room and left the water running. Brown went downstairs and cleaned himself up, and then proceeded to clean up the house, trying to eliminate any evidence of his being there. He took a rag from the kitchen, covered his hand, wiped down any places he may have touched to eliminate fingerprints, and used the rag to leave the house without leaving any additional fingerprints on the door. Once outside, Brown walked out into the evening and eventually returned, along with the other men, to the Drug Abuse Prevention Center in Santa Cruz, only a short distance from his terrible crime in Capitola. Wilfred Brown is arrested on Sunday, February 11th, 1973. The police do not immediately tell the public they've arrested someone. They want to protect their case. But again, when the public find out a couple of days later, they're very angry the police would let them continue to worry and that someone maybe was dangerous in the area. When Wilfred Brown is arrested, he is sent to juvenile hall. In Santa Cruz, the juvenile hall is at 3650 Graham Hill Road and was built in 1968. It's a small facility meant to hold offenders while they go through a trial or await outcomes after committing a crime, and it's not meant to hold anyone long term. Inside this juvenile hall, there are two units, one for males who are older and who've committed more serious crimes, and the other for females and younger males, or males who are less sophisticated. At this facility, each juvenile has a private room with a toilet, a sink, drinking fountain, and a bed. There's also a day room and an outside area as well. While at this facility, I believe Brown is held in the first unit. However, things start to move very quickly when it comes to the trial portion. In fact, this will be by far the quickest arrest to sentencing we've covered so far. And the main legal question to answer before a trial even begins is whether or not to try Brown as an adult or a juvenile. So what do you guys think? Does the severity of the crime matter? Does the fact that this is his second violent crime affect your opinion on whether or not he should be tried as an adult? What do you guys?
Yeah, for me, it's both. It's the fact that this is a violent crime and that he's a repeat offender. And yeah, just the kind of callousness of it.
I understand what you're saying. I just still feel like he's still considered a kid in other ways of not being able to enlist in the military. Mm-hmm. I don't know what, I mean, probably not alcohol or cigarettes in the 72, but I could be wrong. Could have been like 12 for, you know, but the things that he can't do, but he's tried as an adult. I understand the severity of the crime. And I, even if the sentence is the same as an adult for a juvenile, that's fine. But to consider him an adult, I don't go with that. So
that's interesting. I didn't really think about that. It's usually what we talk about when we say, are you going to be tried as an adult or a juvenile, is that there is a definite difference in the end result.
In the sentencing.
Right. But so if I understand what you're saying is that even if the sentencing was the same, it's the recording part of we are doing this to a juvenile, and that matters more than the sentencing.
It bothers me that because he's not, to me, he is not an adult. Okay. By the law, he is not an adult. Why give him a classification of an adult when he is a juvenile? He had to go to juvenile facility, correct?
Yeah, but then when they arrest him.
They didn't put him in an adult jail. Another thing they did, they put him in this, before this, they put him in the center as a juvenile to
county youth authority.
You know, they did everything else as a juvenile. So I don't know why this has to be an adult.
I think it's interesting because I never really took, and this is something that we've talked a lot about, not just on this podcast, but outside of this podcast as well. And I always took it when we've had these discussions that the juvenile and the adult difference would also be for sentencing. I never really thought about it, that it's the actual act of,
I mean, the severity of the crime, right? Definitely. But still, to me, it might be what apples to potatoes, whatever the term is. I mean, but in my mind, you know, he's still a kid.
It's an interesting distinction then, to if the government is going to try this person, then label the person the way they have treated them in the past, regardless of what they do them. It's interesting. I don't necessarily if I agree with it, but I think it's you have made me think about something differently.
So we'll just go over kind of the way they do this, because for me, I'm kind of in the middle. I don't know how I feel about this kind of thing. And this actually helped me sort of pick a side on the issue. When deciding whether to charge a child as a juvenile or an adult, the court considers several factors. And I got these out of the California Bench Guide. The first is that the charge must be a felony. It also considers how criminally sophisticated the defendant is, whether the defendant can be rehabilitated before they become an adult, because in the juvenile sentencing, once they become an adult or once they turn a certain age, they'll just be let go. Their prior history with the law, the success or failure of the juvenile court in past crimes, as well as any attempts at rehabilitation, and finally, circumstances and gravity of the offense.
Can I ask you a question on that? When it says how criminally sophisticated the defendant is, what is that? Is that the complexity of the crime, or is that the mental capacity of the person?
I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Okay.
I mean, in this case, you have someone who doesn't seem to have a lessened mental capacity, but also was able to think ahead to wipe down the crime scene.
Okay.
And to leave, not leave fingerprints, and maybe even might have been premeditated in some way, those kinds of things.
So counteracting earlier when you talked about the police saying that this looked like it was through the red haze of passion, that fact alone, the fact that I'm wiping down the crime scene, says that it's it has a forethought to the crime.
It changes how we look at, or how a judge might look at the defendant, whether this was an act of, like, you didn't have good ability to make a decision, or whether you clearly made a choice and acted rationally, that kind of thing.
And another question having to do with the sentencing, because I want to make sure that we understand this. In this case, when we're not talking, as per our previous conversation, when we were talking about what we think of that at this time in the 70s, if I am tried as a juvenile, then at some point, regardless of the crime that I commit, when I turn 25, I walk.
Yes, I believe okay. So. That's what I read.
I think that's still now, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And what I found really interesting, because for me, as I said, this is an issue I'm still figuring out, is really deciding this for a judge seems less about age and more about the crime. And obviously, there are different opinions on that. The juvenile system doesn't call juvenile offenses crimes. They're referred to as delinquent acts. And juveniles don't have a trial. They have an adjudication hearing. So the goal of the juvenile system is rehabilitation. And we've talked about several times in California, the goal of prison under the law is to kind of separate people who are dangerous from the population and to punish and then rehabilitate if possible. And the goal of the juvenile system is really to rehabilitate. So that just kind of changed the way I looked at that, because to me, a crime like this, it doesn't seem like it can be held under the law in a juvenile court. Because it's murder and it's a crime, it's not a delinquent act, which is maybe something we could change in the law.
And the idea of if the juvenile justice system is built around rehabilitation, then those psychiatrists, that determination, like going back when he was first arrested, that determination carries a lot more weight than really for a juvenile court than any of the evidence. Is this quote-unquote juvenile, has the ability to be rehabilitated.
Right. And the fact that he committed a similar crime again, a very violent crime.
Right.
The crime actually got worse this time. And then also wasn't responding to that rehabilitation from before, I think factors into what the judge will ultimately decide.
Versus then if it was an adult trial, then really what matters is it's the evidence. Did that person commit the crime? Was there premeditation?
Well, they'll both matter. They'll both matter. But I mean, we're just talking about moving
from one,
deciding which actual courtroom or which system will deal with this crime. In March of 1973, a dispositional hearing is held. This is a hearing held to determine something. And in this case, it's whether or not Brown should be tried as an adult and where he should be held while standing trial. So a lot of the history behind the CYA is not just about being fair to the individual, but also protecting other children. So for instance, if someone is a violent offender, you're allowing them access and influence over kids who may be younger than them or even the same age if they're kept in a youth facility when they really should be kept in, the theory is, in a prison. The judge decides that Brown is, quote, not a fit subject for juvenile treatment.
You were talking about California Youth Authority and their responsibility to the accused to make sure that person is treated correctly, but then also all of the other children or adolescents or teenagers that are in County Youth Authority to protect them from some other predators or...
Right.
Okay. So in this case, when the judge decides that Brown is not a fit subject for juvenile treatment, is there a basis for that?
Yeah, so he's deciding whether two things, whether A, he'll be tried as an adult, and also if in between those things, the trial and now, if he'll be held in a prison as and not in the California Youth Authority. We talked a little bit about how there were kind of four ways that a judge will determine this. He doesn't explicitly say, I don't see anything in the newspaper about how he came to that, but part of it is, has the person committed this crime before? Are they criminally sophisticated? Did treatment, if they had it before, was it helpful? That kind of thing. And this is a case where he has committed a crime before, a pretty violent one, and where he was in treatment and it didn't help. He committed this other crime. So I think he kind of looked at those issues.
Well, and the sophistication level, the fact that he went out and like put her someplace to make it look like she was drowning, wiped off fingerprints and things like that.
Yeah, and they also definitely, that part, and they also considered the violentness of the
crime. How violent it was. Okay.
So while this is all going on, the district attorney impanels a grand jury in the hopes of securing an indictment against Brown in the murder of Ida Stein. He's able to get an indictment, and this is a big deal as they move towards trial. In late March, a preliminary hearing is held, and Brown is asked to enter a plea. He's just been given a public defender, so his lawyers put off entering that plea because they haven't had the chance to review the case or even talk with their client. So during this hearing, the judge decides that Brown will remain at juvenile hall for the time being instead of being transferred to adult jail to await trial. He's being held without bail. So even though a judge has already said he's going to be tried as an adult and he's awaiting that trial, he's still going to be held for the time being.
Why? Is there a reason? Like, was it stated there was a reason for that?
It doesn't say in the newspaper, so I'm not sure the reasoning behind that. On April 3rd, Brown enters a plea. He pleads not guilty by reason of insanity.
It's funny that we've talked about how less than 1%, and we've picked a couple cases that actually have it, you know. And
yeah, that keeps coming back.
Right, which is just odd. We're just picking them, I guess.
Which would be interesting, and I guess this is, we can do a little research, or if you're listening to this and know, please post up on our social media. But I'd like to know how many cases, both in California and maybe nationwide, how many times that's offered up as a plea.
Like total?
Yeah. I mean, because we hear that a lot, you know, less than 1%, it works. But how many times is it offered? And whether that, like in this case, is Brown's lawyer saying, this is what we're going to try because of your age and what went on? Or is Brown himself saying, I was insane when I did this, or I was in a blind rage? Or
the public defender is like, your case is solid against you. We're going to throw this long shot out there and right, try the 1%.
One way or the other, you're going to go to prison. So,
yeah.
And also, like you mentioned, Jessica, in the newspaper, the way the police are responding to this and describing that it's a super violent scene. It looks like it was a madman that did it. No sane person would be able to do this. I mean, it's already kind of colored in the public's opinion. So if you're banking on a jury being selected from the area, and you know this woman was well loved and a pillar of the community, like you said, just try anything.
Yeah.
So in California, this would mean that at the time of the murder, Brown was incapable of knowing right from wrong or understanding the nature of the crime.
That's just, is that like the passion of the crime? Like not afterwards? How we've always already talked about how it seemed meticulous. He cleaned up. He put her in the bathtub. Now, is this insanity plea only for the time the crime is committed? Or is this the after, like the actual murdering part?
He's going to be evaluated by psychiatrists, and they will look at both. If he's sane now, after the murder, if he was sane before and during.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like, where does the insanity plea start?
Right.
And where does it stop? Do you have to be, like, if I'm completely rational, I mean, again, crime of passion, right? I'm completely rational up to the point of something snaps.
Like when she grabbed his hand to pray.
Right.
And then supposedly that's when he got.
Right.
So is that when the insanity starts?
And then where does it stop?
Brown's lawyer is named Tom Prosser, and he's a public defender. On April 27th, a hearing is held so a psychiatrist who interviewed Brown can give their testimony on whether or not he was sane, as we said, during the crime and sane now to stand trial. The psychiatrist tells the court that Brown was sane in both instances. After the psychiatrist gives their finding and it's accepted by the court, Prosser does something I haven't seen anyone do in any of the cases we've covered so far. He asks the judge to give a decision of guilt or innocent on the spot, foregoing Brown's right to a trial by jury of his peers.
So that's something that he has to get Brown's approval for, right?
I assume so. I don't really know. I've never seen anything we've covered like this. And I tried to look up, because I know you can obviously choose to have a trial by jury, or you can choose to have a bench trial with just a judge. But this is just, they went for this hearing and on the spot, he wants the judge to decide. And I've never seen anything like that.
No, I never even heard of something like that.
And I couldn't find anything like it. So it obviously exists because it happens here, but.
This might be off topic, but is there any stats on ones that go to jury and ones by the judge where they lean either way? Like, is jury more guilty and judge more innocent?
That's interesting, because we've talked a lot about different cases where the defense was worried about getting a fair trial given the nature of the crime and the area that it was covered in. Maybe the same type of thing. Maybe Prosser knows, again, like we talked about, she's a pillar in the community, the heinousness of this crime, which every crime is heinous, but...
Maybe the he just thinks that the judge would be more fair?
Might be, or more lenient, or more likely to...
It almost seems to me like accepting a plea deal. They had, I mean, Brown has told, he's confessed to police of this. They have tons of evidence. Their only hope, I think, was that he might not have been sane at the time. And then that doesn't happen. So I think it's kind of like just accepting there's no other defense.
Oh, okay.
That's how it felt to me, but it was very different than accepting a plea deal. And that word was never used, so.
Yeah, or having that discussion outside of court.
Does this have anything to do with him being a minor? Because I know that he's being tried as an adult, but is this like a...
Yeah, I really don't know. I wish that I did. And I searched a lot for this, and I couldn't find it in other cases. And maybe it's done in cases that aren't as covered, but...
Mm-hmm. I think there's just a lot of questions that we won't be able to answer.
No.
So the judge agrees to give a judgment, and in order to make his decision, he uses the grand jury testimony, the autopsy report, and the psychiatrist report to find Brown guilty of first-degree murder. Before passing down a sentence, the judge asks if Brown has anything he needs to say. And I just want to remind you, first-degree murder in this case is also with a special circumstance. So it carries with it a penalty of possible being put to death.
So the death penalty is on the table at this time.
Right, or life in prison without parole. Those are both possibilities. And because he murdered someone, but he also raped them.
And the special circumstance in this case is the rape.
Yeah. Wilford Brown, clothed in blue jeans and a bright yellow sweater, stood and said, quote, "What can I say? I'm sorry about it. I don't know what was going to happen. What can anybody say? Truly, I am sorry, and I don't wish to go to state prison." The judge also allowed the assistant district attorney and Brown's attorney to make a statement. Prosser, the public defender, asked the court for leniency. The reason he gave for this is that he believed it's what Mrs. Stein would want. He said, quote, "She's a very religious person who lived a very worthwhile life, and I suspect if she were alive today, she would urge the court to act leniently."
That bothers me.
Yeah, when I first read this in the newspaper, I wasn't clear if the lawyer had any knowledge of Mrs. Stein or had knew her before or knew some family or anything like that. So it really bothered me because it seemed like...
Like you're some guy who's using the victim as a way of getting your client off or leniency.
Unless he did talk to someone, maybe people at the church or something like that. But
I mean, that's a possibility, but even in family.
But they should have had, because don't they have, during this part, family and friends usually
victim
say...
Victim impact statements. Yeah,
so that could have been someone else besides him saying it.
They might have had somebody. This was just supposed to be a hearing for sanity, so I'm not really sure that other people would have really gone to this like they would have a regular trial, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because
it's not even a real... It's not the real trial.
Because he just threw it out there. Hey, judge. Okay. That makes sense. And so, yeah. Maybe he's not that cool of a dude.
It seems I wasn't the only one bothered because after the trial, a letter to the editor is written by a Reverend Melvin B. Nonhoff, who had heard about this plea by Prosser in the paper, and it really made him angry. He knew Ida Stein, and he didn't think that Prosser had ever met her, and he was livid at the idea that he spoke for her at trial like that. According to Nonhoff, he had conversations with Ida Stein about the justice system and capital punishment, and while she did believe in helping people, she also believed in people taking responsibility for their actions. The district attorney asked the court for a heavy sentence, in part because of the violent nature of the crime, but also because Brown had already failed at the California Youth Authority and at his second chance. After everyone spoke, the judge sentenced Brown to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 7 years. And during sentencing, Brown showed no emotion. I don't know how you guys feel about... So he didn't get the worst sentencing he could have.
He didn't get the death penalty.
Maybe just I don't have that much knowledge. Is everyone able for parole in 7 years? Or was that just in this case?
I think that's determined by...
The judge.
By the judge and the sentence. So
he went... Somewhat lenient.
Yeah.
Because no death sentence and 7 years he could get out. I mean, it's probably not a big chance, but I'm just saying that he did give him the chance.
It's, yeah, I'm kind of torn. I think it gives us, this is an opportunity to give him some form of chance to rehabilitate and to show the state that he's amended his ways. I don't know.
It's hard.
Yeah, you know, it's not like Ida Stein gets a chance to.
Right.
Wilfred Riley Brown is still in jail to this day. His parole has been denied a series of times by the Board of Prison Terms because he's refused to participate in treatment. In 2014, he was refused parole because, quote, untreated predatory nature and sexual deviancy. He was again denied parole in 2019. He's currently being held in San Quentin and is 63 years old. He will be eligible for parole again in 2024. Ida Stein was unfortunately one of far too many murders in the Santa Cruz area in the 1970s. Most people can name or have at least heard of one of the major murderers who stalked the area at the time, but often the victims and their loved ones are not as easily recalled. Ida Stein was an important part of her Capitola and church community. She, like all the victims of the time, deserved to be remembered.
In tonight's cold case, the information for this episode comes from the Santa Cruz Police Department website and an article in the Santa Cruz Sentinel titled, "Questions Remain in Death of Hotel Guest." On August 12, 1984, San Jose resident Carol Panzica checked into the Dream Inn Hotel in Santa Cruz, California, with her two sons, age 11 and 13. The three of them checked in at 3 p.m., and the two boys went outside to play and used the hotel's swimming pool. When the boys got back at 6 p.m., they found their mother, who had stayed behind to take a shower or bath, face down in the tub filled with water. The boys screamed for help and another hotel guest responded to their cries. This person pulled Carol out of the tub. A beach patrol officer also responded to the scene and did CPR until the fire department and ambulance arrived. Carol was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. When investigators looked at her body, they initially thought she had slipped in the shower, fell, and her body blocked the drain, causing the tub to fill, drowning her. There were wounds consistent with this theory. A pathologist looked at the body and found other wounds that were inconsistent with an accident drowning. These wounds included bruises on the body that were unexplained. Her death was ruled a homicide. If you have any information about this case, you can call the Santa Cruz Police Department at 831-420-5820 or their tip line at 831-420-5995.
Thank you for listening to California True Crime. If you're so inclined, please follow us on your favorite social media, at Cali True Crime on Twitter and Instagram. You can join our Facebook group. Look for California True Crime on Facebook. We also have a Patreon set up. Go over and check that out. Check out our website, californiatruecrime.com, for episode notes and a little more fun stuff. As always, we'd like to thank our captain of quality control, Melanie Duncan. This has been a production of Wagrimus.